we're reading from Adi Lila, chapter 8. Adi Lila 8, text 17. Gyanataha su labha muktir bhuktir yajyadi punyataha seyam sadhana sahasra hari bhakti sudurlabha gyanatasu labha muktir muktir yajyadi punyataha seyam sadhana sahasra sadhana sahasra hari bhakti sudurlabha. So would anybody like to guess what this verse means? Gyanata sulabha muktir. By jnana, it's easy to get mukti. Muktir, sense gratification, yajyadi, by jagyas and punya and pious activities, you get sense gratification. Seyam sadhana sahasraya hari bhakti sudurlabha. But by practicing these things for thousands of years, you won't get bhakti. Anyway, we'll read the synonyms. Let me just read the verse. Gyanata sulabha muktir bhuktir yajyari punyataha seyam sadhana sahasraya hari bhakti sudurlabha. Word meanings. Gyanata. By cultivation of knowledge. Sulabha. Easily obtained. Excuse me. Easily obtainable. Mukti, liberation. Bhukti, sense enjoyment. Yajyadi, performances of sacrifices, etc. Punyataha, and by performing pious activities. Sa, that. Iyam, this. Sadhana sahasra. Execution of thousands of sacrifices. Puri bhaktihi. Devotional service. Sudurlabha. Is very rare. Translation. By cultivating philosophical knowledge, one can understand his spiritual position and thus be liberated. And by performing sacrifices and pious activities, one can achieve sense gratification in a higher planetary system. But the devotional service of the Lord is so rare that even by executing hundreds and thousands of such sacrifices, one cannot obtain it. Somehow or other, we got it. Congratulations, everyone. You hit the jackpot. Prahlad Maharaj instructs, Matirna Krishne Parata Shutova Mito Vipadita Rihavratanam. 7:5:30. He also instructs, Naisham Matis Tavad Urukramangri Sprisatyanap Ha pagamo yadartha. And he also instructs, Mahiyasham paro rajo vishekam. Same verse. Niskinchananam navranita yavat. That's from the 7th canto, 5th chapter, 32nd verse. These shlokas are to be discussed. Their purport is that one cannot obtain Krishna bhakti or the devotional service of the Lord by official execution of the Vedic rituals, one has to approach a pure devotee. Narottam Das Thakur sings, Jadiya Vaishnava Seva Nishthara Payecha Keva. Who knows what that means? Jadiya Vaishnava Seva Nishthara Payecha Keva. Who has been elevated without rendering service to a pure devotee? That's the translation. It is the statement of Prahlad Maharaj that unless one is able to accept the dust from the lotus feet of a pure Vaishnava, there is no possibility of achieving the platform of devotional service. That is the secret. The above-mentioned Tantra Vachana, quoted from the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu 1.136, is our perfect guide in this connection. So what this verse is nicely explaining, ultimately, that we don't get bhakti through our own efforts, but we get bhakti by the kripa or the mercy of the Vaishnava. But the interesting thing is, unless you make an effort, you don't get the mercy. So Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, unless we make our best efforts and thereby attract the mercy of Krishna, it's virtually impossible to get bhakti. So you would think, by definition, mercy means you don't have to make any effort, it just comes. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur is saying, you get the mercy by making the effort. So there's a balance there. Just like you have in the Gita, where Krishna is telling Arjuna, do something. I'll do it, but you do it. So it works, you have to work it together. Because Krishna, he doesn't reciprocate unless you show an interest. And even if you want it, in one letter, a devotee asked Prabhupada, is it okay to pray to Krishna? I forget what she was asking, to pray to Krishna for something. Prabhupada said, it's okay to pray as long as you're acting. As long as you're acting in alignment with what you're praying, as opposed to praying and doing nothing. So I'll pray to Krishna, Krishna, I need this, and then I won't do anything. I'll just wait for it to come. So it's not like that. So there's this balance. Krishna wants to see the effort, not just the prayer. And that's what we learn from the Damodar pastime. Because Mother Yashoda made the effort, but Krishna wasn't allowing it to happen. And there's a nice story. I don't know if you know the story about Draupadi. You know, when Draupadi was in distress, and she was praying, O Govinda, I think it was Satyabhama, she could hear Krishna and Satyabhama were together. Sisi Radha Golokananda ki. Krishna and Satyabhama were together and they could hear Draupadi calling Krishna. So Satyabhama said, why aren't you going? Because Krishna wasn't going. And then Krishna answered, he said, well, it's too late, I can't get there fast enough. She didn't understand. Again they heard Draupadi calling. And so Satyabhama said, well, what about Garuda? What about this and that? Krishna said, it's not fast enough. I can't get there fast enough. And then Draupadi called with more intensity and she was crying. And then Krishna said, now I can go and I can travel on the chariot of her tears. So, I can travel on the chariot of her tears. So in other words, the intensity wasn't enough to get Krishna to go there. And then when it reached a certain intensity, then. So yesterday I was at Vasudev's house and he told me a story about his famous deity, Shyam. That a young woman in the neighborhood, he said that people know about their deities in the neighborhood, not just the Hindus, but other people. They know about mystical power of their deity. So one lady had been diagnosed with cancer. She didn't have long to live, and so Sadhana said, just pray to my deities. Pray to my shaman. So this lady, she said this lady went in, and she you know, was a young mother, and if she died, that means she'd be leaving her kids. And so she was very intensely praying, I'm not ready to leave, my family needs me. And Sadhana said, very, very intense prayer. And she said that lady never died of cancer. She was completely cured. Which makes their deities even more famous. So, but what Sadhana said, it was the intensity of the prayer. So this is, you know, because the lady, she had nothing. The doctors had given up on her. So, the intensity with which we show Krishna is that to that degree Krishna reciprocates. So that's the idea. And we should never think that it's only by mercy, but at the same time we should understand it is by mercy, but the real thing is, how do you get it? So Krishna wants to see some action, some effort, right? Now, the attitude of the devotee is that I'm helpless. And that's why the devotee prays to Krishna. But because he thinks he's helpless, he doesn't mean he doesn't act. But it means internally, while he's acting, he's not feeling qualified. And so we were talking about this yesterday. And I think one of the downfalls in Krishna consciousness is we feel somewhat special or qualified. So actually, I'm good, I'm smart, I'm better than others. So that's the beginning of the end. Because the devotee always feels, no, I'm not qualified. Krishna, you help me. Unfortunately, we have history, and what happened that after Prabhupada left, there was a thinking, because we didn't understand, that Prabhupada had appointed 11 devotees to initiate, at least on his behalf, and then the assumption was they would become Diksha Gurus after that, and an assumption right at that time was that there was some Shakti that was given to them that was not given to anybody else. And it wasn't just that they thought that, but other people thought that. So the God brothers thought, okay, Prabhupada picked them. Remember, that was even a question. Did he really pick them to be guru, or did he just pick them to be initiate on his behalf while he was present? But in any case, it was thought that they were special. And some of those gurus also believed that. And that was the downfall, that they thought they were more special than anyone else. So this one Christian writer, he said, the people who have the most difficult time being humble are the people that are good, honest people, moral people, because they know they're better than everyone else. So that they have a hard time being humble. Because they don't lie, they don't cheat, they're straightforward, they're moral, they're righteous. So those people have a hard time being humble. You would think they wouldn't, but they're the ones that have the hardest time. Because when you're endowed with any kind of quality, any kind of good quality or ability or intelligence, then it becomes more difficult to be humble. Because you can see that you have these qualities. So the proper attitude of the devotee, and Prabhupada exemplified this, is to think, I'm not qualified. And when I was a temple president, as a very young devotee, Prabhupada wrote me a letter and he said, you should think you're not qualified. And he said, actually you should think you're so unqualified that you have to pray to Krishna to give the qualifications. And if he doesn't give the qualifications, Prabhupada said, you should think all the devotees will leave. Like the whole thing, the whole temple will just fall apart. I'm not qualified. So in that way, Prabhupada was saying, then you'll get the qualification. But not necessarily even get the qualification, but then Krishna can work through you. It's like, so what happened in that temple was interesting. It was in 1970, 1971, so the movement was very young. And we didn't have any kind of bhakti program. We didn't really know how to make devotees, so to speak. We just preached. We didn't really know how to train devotees, but I really wanted to make devotees, and I really felt helpless in doing so. And in a year and a half, about 15 devotees joined that temple. I went there, and there were three other devotees. In a year and a half, 15 people joined. Because of the helplessness, Krishna, I can't do this. So it's dangerous to think we can do something. And Krishna will say, okay, do it. You're so good, go do it. You don't need me, go do it. Right? So even if you're not so talented and you say, Krishna, I'm not very good at this, Krishna will say, okay, I'll do it. You make the effort, but I'll do it. As long as you think that you can't do it, then you're good. And so Prabhupada showed that in his poem, Krishna, I'm not qualified. Why did you bring me here? I'm useless. But if you like, you can make me dance. So it's the same mood, right? I don't know how to dance. You can make me dance. If that's what you want, then make me dance. So that's a safe position for us, if we always feel that way. Okay, Krishna, I'm not qualified. And whatever talent I may have, I know that's your mercy, but I should never think that I'm in any way qualified. And that's how we become empowered. And that's how Krishna really gives us qualifications to do amazing things. It's like in South Africa. You know, I was there in 1981, and Tulsi Das was managing, and Partasarathy was doing his tent campaign. And Tulsi Das was a very good manager. So he's telling me, he was saying that Partasarathy Maharaj, he said, he's not a good manager, but because he's such a good devotee, Krishna sends him everything. So he sends him all the people that can manage all the resources. So what he accomplishes is the same thing that a good manager would accomplish, but he's not a good manager. It gets done anyway. So, you know, Krishna can make up for what you lack by sending people that you lack. Just like Steve Jobs, he understood that principle. So he said, there were so many things I couldn't do, so I just hired people that could do it, because he understood his where he lacked. And it's important for devotees to understand where they lack, what they're not good at, so they can get other people to do it. But sometimes our false ego is such that we want to do everything, and we think we're good at everything. But actually, it's very important to know what you're not good at, so you don't mess it up. You're not good at something, so I can't fix cars, and your car breaks down. So let me do something and start, moving things around. Then you have to get your car repaired and spend 10,000 more rupees because I messed it up. Right? So you need to know what you're not good at. That's part of being empowered. Krishna, I'm not good at this, help me. So sometimes that help, it may come in terms of insight, intelligence. It may come in terms of Krishna sending you somebody who has insight and intelligence, and you recognize, yes, I'm not good at this, I pray to Krishna, he sent somebody to help me. So that's a recognition. Now, a lot of times our false ego is such, we don't even know what we're not good at, because we don't want to admit we're not good at something. Isn't it? Which is really crazy, because varnashram means everybody's has a certain nature. So, if you're a Brahmin, you're not a Shudra. Well, in this Kali Yuga, there's mixtures. Is it bad that you're a Brahmin and you can't manage, or is it bad you can manage and you're not intellectual? No, it's just your nature. And so because you know it, you engage it. It's fine. And because you know what you're not, you try to do business. You those of you who are businessmen, some devotees, they can't make money. Even if you gave them money, you gave them a million rupees, you come back in 10 years, they'd be bankrupt. And you give somebody 10 rupees as a business person, and you come back and he owns half the island. It's just nature, right? So we have to know what our nature is, so we engage it. I know what I'm good at, I know what I'm not good at. And if by circumstance Krishna wants me to do something I'm not so good at because nobody else can do it, Krishna help me, I don't know how to do this. Please help me, guide me, give me intelligence. And I've seen also, in terms of devotee relationships, I've seen how some very nice devotees end up with very bad relationships because they're engaged in services they're not good at and they frustrate people. They just drive everybody crazy because they don't know how to do it. But they're really nice devotees, but people end up disliking them because they mess things up. So it's good to know what you mess up, so you don't mess it up. And it's not a question of false ego. It's just the way it is, right? Some people are good at some things, and it doesn't mean if you're good at something you're more Krishna conscious. It doesn't mean you're not good, you're less Krishna conscious. In the early days of the movement, like we were saying last night, you know, we come with so many ideas that are left over from our conditioning in the material world. So one of the ideas that many people had was move up in the company, you know, go higher, get a position. And they would equate position with advancement. Well, you know, if I get a position, it must mean I'm advanced. It doesn't necessarily mean you're advanced or not advanced. It might mean you're advanced and Krishna's picking you for that position. It might mean you just want it. Or it might mean you're just good at something. So Krishna gives you that position. And the attitude of a devotee is, if we're good at something, say, Krishna, thank you. I can use this in your service. As one devotee told me, he was a devotee from Ukraine. He was the number one book distributor in Ukraine. So we were talking about humility, and he said that at one point he became very proud that he was the number one book distributor, and then he kind of hit a threshold of pride. The next day he went out and nobody would take a book from him. Krishna just said, okay, that's it. It's over, Prabhu. I'm not going to let you, if you think like this, I'm not going to let you sell any books now. He said it was very clear what Krishna was doing. He said he couldn't, just nobody would take a book from him. And then he understood what was happening, and then again he developed a proper mood, humility, and then he was able to distribute books. So sometimes Krishna can, you know, he can just foil our abilities and plans if he wants. Because, you know from Bhagavatam, Krishna in the Shastra, Krishna doesn't like it when devotees become proud. So when the devotee becomes proud, Krishna can just go, okay, that's it for you. See you later. You're gone. And he can do that very easily. He doesn't like it when his devotees become proud. And you see, in Shastra, when a devotee exhibits humility, it's what attracts Krishna. Because humility is actually, in the CC, it says humility is an ornament of prema. So it's just like a jewel on prema. So naturally, it's attractive to Krishna. But the interesting thing is, humility is attractive to everybody, not just Krishna. It's like it has its own fragrance. You know, when you're like Jayananda Prabhu, he had extreme humility, and the reality was everybody loved him. He was just this very, very Krishna conscious devotee, basically senior to 95%. 98% of the devotees. And when he was in San Francisco, he was the senior most devotee. Was I telling you yesterday when he was taking out the trash? Was I mentioning that? Maybe that was somewhere else. He would do services like wash the pots, take out the trash, fix the cars. So you know, if you read his biography, and a lot of devotees will say, you know, he made me a devotee and he was preaching to me from underneath the car because he was fixing the car while he was preaching to me. And for a lot of devotees, it was like a paradox because if you heard him speak, you understood he was very Krishna conscious. I think, why is he fixing a car? Or why is he washing the pots? Why is he taking out the trash? But as they got to know him, they just they understood it was just his nature. That's who he was. But everybody loved him because he had that nature. There's a nice story to just show how attractive this quality of humility is and how attractive he was. There was, he would organize Rath Yatra, the first Rath Yatra in San Francisco, and then he wanted to do Rath Yatra in Los Angeles. No, I think this was in San Francisco, but we'd do these Rath Yatras in public places, and the thing about it is, it wasn't guaranteed every year you would get the permit. You might have done Rath Yatra for 10 years in a row, and you go the 11th year, and they say, this year we're not giving the permit, the rules have changed. You know, and 100,000 people are waiting for the festival. It's been at the spot for 10 years. Like it happened in South Africa. They lost that spot. Now they got it back. So there was one lady, the devotees say, who was very, I don't want to say nasty, but for lack of a better word, kind of nasty. And she was the lady they had to get the permit from. And so she was difficult. All the devotees said she was a difficult lady to deal with. Like never smiled, kind of nasty, kind of hard, harsh. And so Jayananda would have to deal with her every year. She's just like, you know, very cold, tough lady. So after Jayananda left his body, of course the Rath Yatra was going to continue, but he was not going. He couldn't go now. He'd left his body to meet the lady. So the other devotees went, and the lady said, "Where?" They called him Johnny Ananda. That's how. Where's Johnny Ananda? And they told the lady, this hard, rough, tough lady, they told her that he left his body. And on the spot, she broke down. She just started crying. Because he was like that. He was so genuine, and he was so not about himself. And, you know, people felt that. So this is real. So my point was that Krishna's attracted to humility, but we're attracted to it also. And you know, if somebody's very, very proud, it's hard to be with them because it makes you feel uncomfortable, or it makes you feel like you want to compete with them. They're competing with me, I have to compete with him. So, anyway. So when we have that attitude, then Krishna can do things through us. Now, this morning I mentioned something, I think I'd like to talk about it. I think it's relevant to this. When I was here, when I was last here, and when I was temple president, we were on the farm, and Mr. Tilak was there. And something was on my mind, and I was thinking, you know, every time any one of my godbrothers would come here, they'd preach, and they'd always say, and Prabhupada said, Mauritius will be the first Krishna conscious country. That was what everybody heard. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt it doesn't exactly make sense according to our philosophy that it would just happen. It's not like why would it just happen here? You know, like nowhere else. This could be, you know, or will be. You know, that was the rumor, right? It will be. You know, at least what my godbrothers, what I heard when I'm outside of Mauritius. Oh, you're in Mauritius? Oh, Prabhupada said it'll be the first Krishna conscious country. And I would think, how could it just happen? You know, there's one place. Why this place? Especially if you live here long enough, you really start doubting whether that statement was true. Right? Because it doesn't look like, you know, preaching's going on everywhere. Why here? And, you know, it's good in South Africa. Preaching's phenomenal in Russia. Why not Russia, the first Krishna? Why not India? You know, it's not like, I mean, things preaching here is great, but it's great in so many places, right? And you know, if you live here, it could be much greater than it is. So I'm thinking, well, it could be much greater, but it's not, for whatever reason. it's not as great as it could be, so why here? Why not Fiji? Why not Delhi? Why not Moscow, you know? So by chance, Mr. Tilak was at the farm. We're having a meeting, or we just were taking prasadam or something, I think Giriyashami was there, myself, Shiniketa. So, and prior to this, I was asking people, older devotees, and particularly people, whenever I had the chance to meet anybody that met Prabhupada, when Prabhupada came, those few rare people, I would say, did you ever hear Prabhupada say that Mauritius is going to be the first Krishna conscious country? And not one of them said they heard that. So I was becoming suspicious. I was already suspicious, and I was thinking, okay, nobody's heard it. This is a rumor. It can't be that Prabhupada said it. But he must have said something, because we wouldn't just make this up. Right? He must have said something. So I said, Mr. Tilak, you're with Prabhupada more than anybody. Did Prabhupada say Krishna conscious, Mauritius will be the first Krishna conscious country? Because if anybody would have heard it, it would have been him, right? And he said, no. And then about a minute later, he said, but he did say it could be the first Krishna conscious country. And I said, that's what I thought. That's what I thought, because that was my intuition. And then I got another confirmation. I mean, isn't it more empowering that it could be? If it will be, wake me up when it happens, Prabhu. I'll come and join you. Right? I mean, it's going to happen. I don't have to do anything. It's already Prabhupada said it's going to happen. Somebody's going to do it. I don't have to take responsibility. So, in a morning walk conversation, Prabhupada's servant said, Prabhupada, Lord Chaitanya predicted every town and village. How far is that statement true? He was asking him, is that actually true that Lord Chaitanya's name will be known in every town and village? Because it seems that's also a prediction which inevitably will happen. And Prabhupada said the same thing. He said, that depends on those who are preaching. How far they preach. Yes, how far it will happen, somebody has to do it. Right? So, okay, it can happen. Prabhupada said this can be the first. Why could it be? Because there was, at that time, things were different. Hindu government wasn't highly industrialized. It was a nice situation. But point remains, how far it will happen, that depends on the preachers. It always depends on the preachers. It depends on the preachers, and then if we put that idea together with this verse, it depends on the preachers, and the preachers depend on Krishna. So Krishna, do any of you feel like you could make this country Krishna conscious? Do any of you feel like you could run this country? I mean, what if this country becomes Krishna conscious? We have to run it. Any of you feel qualified to run this country? Like, what would you do if you're the prime minister? Would you close down all the slaughter, whatever you have, slaughterhouses or chicken? So would you ban all the alcohol? Would you close all the industry and tell everybody to go to the land? Make it illegal to Jai Sisi Radha Golokana? Would you make petrol illegal in 10 years? Everybody has to have a battery-powered car or a car power. Like in this country, you could probably have a sail, you could call it a sail car instead of a sailboat. It's so windy. Put up your sail and travel. What would you do? So Prabhupada said it could be. So naturally, as devotees, we should think, Krishna, please. How do we do this? I have no idea, please. So the same mood Prabhupada said. Look at Prabhupada. He's coming from Vrindavan. You've all probably been to Vrindavan. But imagine you were living in Vrindavan. You've never been out of India. And then from about whenever Prabhupada went to Vrindavan, I don't know, in the early 60s, late 50s, till whenever, maybe mid 50s. He's living in Vrindavan, then he goes to New York and he's preaching to hippies. How could you understand? A hippie was something that was inconceivable for a Brajvasi. They're just like, they're like monsters to them, you know? They're like animals, like not even like subhuman beings. And so Prabhupada's coming there and he's praying to Krishna and he said, how will these people understand? I have no idea how they'll understand. So please make my speaking suitable. And if you actually look at Prabhupada's preaching, and if you've heard any of Prabhupada's godbrothers preach, you understand how Krishna empowered Prabhupada to preach exactly what they needed to hear. Because typically Gaudiya Math, when they preach, is very philosophical. Very, very philosophical. And Prabhupada was like the grandfather coming in, and he just, you know, it's like picking us up by the hand, pulling us out of Maya. You know, just practical and loving and making everything understandable and simplified. Because generally, the preaching, you know Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's preaching was very elevated. And generally in the Gaudiya Math, that's how they preach. Very philosophical, very, very shastric, academic. All the Gaudiya Math devotees, all great scholars, you know. And Prabhupada came and he brought it down. It was like just perfectly understood. That was obviously Krishna's empowerment. Because he was feeling like, how is this philosophy going to be understood? I have no idea how they'll understand it. Please make my speaking suitable so they can understand. So that's the mood. That's how we feel. How can I do this? I have a mission. Just like Prabhupada has given us all a mission to make the world Krishna conscious. How could we do that? But that's the mission. How do you do that? You know, 1969, Prabhupada's sitting with his disciples and he says, by 1975, I want all of you to become gurus. And he didn't mean Siksha Guru, he meant Diksha Guru. 1969, the average devotee probably been in the movement less than a year and the average age was probably 20. And he's telling them, I want you to become guru, Diksha Guru. How do you do that? Right? Now, if I tell all of you, someday you all have to become Diksha Gurus, you'll say, no way. Pas possible. It'll never happen. It's not possible. Right? That's the immediate reaction. But someday you may have to. It's not like all the Diksha Gurus are going to live forever. Somebody has to do it, right? And at a certain point, they're going to be gone. You can't call them up. There won't be anybody to call up anymore. It's going to have to start becoming more of a homegrown process. Think about hundreds of years from now. So just as it was a shock for those disciples to hear Prabhupada say that, it's also a shock for us to hear that, but it's true. We have to do that. Some of you have to do that. And we all have to be Siksha Guru. That's what Prabhupada wanted. So how do we do it? I'm not qualified. I'm a fallen soul. I can hardly control my own senses. But Krishna help me. Because if Krishna doesn't empower us, how will we do it? And that's what Prabhupada wanted. I mean, it's interesting. Outside of Fiji and Mauritius, Prabhupada never said any country could be Krishna conscious. So it's like, you know, you live here, so it's kind of a burden. You know, I mean, I always felt it as a burden. You know, on one Vyas Puja, we made a cake, and it was the shape of Mauritius. And so we offered it to Prabhupada. I said, here, Prabhupada, we would like to offer you the country. So it's kind of, you know, you can feel it as a burden, you know. Prabhupada said it, so there's a burden. But how to do it? The only way we can do anything is by remaining humble. And as soon as we become proud, then Krishna says, okay, see you later. You're gone. Because he can't use you, right? I mean, he'll let us hang around for a while, you know. But if after a while we don't get it, okay, next, right? And then we learn, right? And many of the godbrothers that we felt that when some very, very advanced devotee had become proud and therefore fell down from Krishna consciousness, we felt that Krishna was showing us and saying, see what happened. You don't have to make the same mistake. They made it for you. Yeah, they showed you. They were way more advanced than you were, and look what happened to them. And then sometimes you go to places around the world where devotees aren't particularly qualified, but they're very dependent on Krishna, and things happen. Somebody comes and helps with this, somebody comes and helps with that. Just like, you know the story. You know the story how the first Bhagavad Gita was published? You know, Prabhupada wanted, because the movement had no funds to publish it, so the only way it could be published was for a professional publisher. Published it. So Prabhupada told Brahmananda, go around, find a publisher. He couldn't find anybody, huh? Bhagavad Gita, who's interested in Bhagavad Gita in America in 1966? Nobody. I don't even know what the book is. So they made an album, and then they got a letter that a man wanted to buy the album, and the man worked at Macmillan, which is one of the biggest publishing companies in America, maybe the world at that time. And Brahmananda told Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, bring the Gita and ask them. You know, Brahmananda had basically given up. You know, nobody's going to publish this book. And he didn't think Macmillan would publish it because it's such a prestigious company. You know, maybe a little publisher might, but this is a huge publisher. Anyway, he brings the book. He meets the guy, sells the album, and then he tells the guy, you know, I have this book, Bhagavad Gita. And the guy was just working in the accounting department. And I forget exactly what happened, but either some man walked in or he got him in touch. And the man found out that he had a Bhagavad Gita. You know the story? I think the man just kind of like was in the department or something. And the man said, you have a Bhagavad Gita? And it's exactly what we're looking for. By an Indian Swami, it's exactly what we're looking for. And the man right on the spot, he said, we'll publish it. Didn't even see the manuscript. You know, so, Krishna works like that. I mean, look at this property. You got this property, it was in the middle of nowhere, right? Now look at it. Yeah, Bhubaneswar, middle of the property, middle of nowhere. Center of the city. Chatsworth, South Africa, middle of nowhere, center of the... Who can understand all these things, right? And we're just instruments, we're just fiddling around here, you know, right? We don't know what we're doing, you know. We don't even half the time know how much money we have in the bank, and somehow or other, you know, Krishna's still working through us. So, Krishna likes to work through those kinds of devotees who are ambitious to spread Krishna consciousness, who understand their disqualifications and are willing to depend on Krishna to do something wonderful. And are willing to dream, say, I would like to do this, I don't know how, but I'm willing to be an instrument and I'm willing to allow Krishna to do it. It's nice to think of this in terms of service to Guru and Krishna. For myself, I don't need to have any big project. For myself, I don't need to be anyone important. But for service of my Guru, then I will do it. Just like now, right now, Radhanath Swami's preaching in the West was based around the book he wrote. Because, at least in America, when you write a book, you do what's called book tours and book signings. So you present your book either at a bookstore or in a rented place, and you present and you talk about your book. Then people buy your book and then you sign it. And then sometimes when you do these book tours, you can get on television and radio, which is a lot more difficult than in a small country. In America, it's difficult to get on. And so what Radhanath Swami has done is he's kind of positioned himself as a sadhu. He just comes on as a sadhu. And through his connections, through disciples and others, he gets more and more speaking engagements in higher and higher places. Maybe you saw on YouTube that he spoke to the Parliament, British Parliament. You know, he met Obama. You know. So he's trying to market himself as a personality, as somebody who becomes well-known, like a Dalai Lama type, you know, as a sadhu. So for a Vaishnava, that's an austerity. To promote yourself is an austerity. Because by nature, you wouldn't do that. But sometimes a devotee will think, for the service of my guru, I'll become famous. I don't know how I'll become famous. I don't know if I deserve to be famous. I don't know if I'm qualified. But for the service of guru, I'll do that. And so, as long as the devotee remains humble, then Krishna will say, okay, let's use you. Because you won't become bewildered or distracted. So that's how it works. And that's how mercy, also how mercy comes, kripa comes. Kripa comes to the humble because the humble need it. If you're proud, why do you need mercy if you're proud? You think you have it together. This is something I noticed in America. It was very interesting. That I noticed a huge difference. I mean, maybe it's changing in India, but traditionally with the older people in India, if they accomplish something noteworthy and you try to glorify them, they'll just say Bhagavan. They'll immediately say, no, it was Bhagavan. That's just how they're trained to understand. It all depends on God. But the consciousness in the West is more, no, I did it myself. I studied, I persevered, I got to the head of my class, I got to the head of my industry, I excelled. How did you do it? Hard work, determination, into all these good qualities, which is true, because you need to do that. But they rule out God in the equation. Yeah, you need determination. It's right there in Nectar of Instruction. Utsahan, nishchaya, darya. You need all this enthusiasm, determination. But in spite of that, the devotee doesn't think, I succeeded because of my determination, my enthusiasm. And he says, I succeeded because I attracted Krishna's mercy. Maybe my enthusiasm attracted his mercy, but it wasn't my enthusiasm. It wasn't why I succeeded. It was because Krishna took compassion on me because I showed him I want to do this. And then he was merciful. So that's the difference. The materialistic perspective is always, I accomplished it. This is how I did it. I worked hard. I'm smart. I studied. I persevered. I was enthusiastic. I was patient, tolerant. And the spiritual perspective is, how did you do this? Bhagavan. That's how it happened. My desire, I hope I was dependent enough on Krishna that I could allow him to work through me. Yes? Makes sense? That's how you get bhakti and that's how you keep it, right? And ultimately, that's how you please Krishna, because he likes that. He likes humble devotees. It's not only how you get bhakti, but it's what makes Krishna happy. Now, is it easy to be humble? Nobody wants to be humble. It's not fun. Everybody wants some recognition. I mean, could you imagine? Remember when we brought the deities here? And so many people did so much to make it happen, and then you're recognizing somebody. Mr. Tilak did this, Mr. Dosha did this, the devotees at the farm did this, the devotees here did this, Trikala did this, Kunti did this, this one, that one, Advaita did this, Chetagru, like. So could you imagine if you were one of the key persons in making that happen and everyone else got glorified except you, how would you feel? Some people, that's how you'd feel. You feel like leaving ISKCON, right? You'd walk out. Some people would, right? So, I'm leaving ISKCON. I worked so hard. Everyone got recognized. but except me. That's our conditioned nature, because we thrive on that. But an advanced devotee would think, thank you, Krishna, that they didn't recognize me. That's how advanced devotee would think, because he doesn't want to be recognized. Right? Like what was that? And who was it? One of the Goswamis, he didn't want his name. When Krishnadas Kaviraj was writing the Chaitanya Charitamrita, he said, don't put my name in this book. Was it Bhugarbha? Maybe there's a number of them, but Gopalbhata. So that's the nature of a Vaishnava, yeah. So they didn't mention my name. Thank you, Krishna. I didn't have to get any honor. How many people would think like that? Because right? Our conditioned nature is, you know, come on, you know, and give it a little applause, you know, I worked hard, you know. Give me some recognition. But the reality is, when you're in that mood, thank you, Krishna, I didn't get recognized, then you're really going to get recognized. Because Krishna knows, now I can recognize you because you don't want it. So now I can trust you to become famous because you don't want it. There's a funny story. When I first came here, either Arjuna asked me or I think Arjuna asked me, he said, do you surf? And I said, well, yeah, I used to surf. I said, is there a beach here where they surf? He goes, oh, yeah. You want to go? I said, yeah. And it was August when I came here in 1981. And August is the surfing season in Tamarind. So when I was a young boy, I did a lot of surfing. I lived by the beach. And one of the things that surfers dream of is to go to an island. Because in California, where I grew up, surfing is very popular. And if you go to the beach there, a spot where there's a lot of good surf, there's hundreds of people surfing. And you're out there for hours and you just get a few waves. We're in somewhere like Mauritius, there's only a few people. And it's like a surfer's paradise. So all these surfers, they dream to go to a tropical island somewhere where they could surf and just lay on the beach, drink coconuts, live cheaply, eat papayas, and surf. And I was just a teenager, so as a surfer, that was our dream, you know, just to be a bum and travel around all these islands. So Arjuna said, well, do you want to go to the beach? And I said, yeah, sure. So it was right in the surfing season, so we got to the beach. And that day, the waves were huge. And I don't know if you're aware of this, if you know this, but Tamarind, that beach in the winter, is famous around the world among surfers as one of the best surfing spots in the world. Yeah. And the funny thing is, about, I don't know, in the early 70s, they did an article on Mauritius. But surfers are very territorial, and they know if a surf spot becomes well known, then South Africans, Australia, everyone's going to come here, and then the spot, which was very secluded, will get packed. So they don't want people to know it, because then it ruins it. They want to have the waves for themselves. So in that magazine, they called the spot the Island of Santosh, because they didn't want anybody to know where it was. Is that another name of this? Island of Santosha? That's what they called it. Anyway, they gave it the name Island of Santosha. So anyway, there I am. I'm sitting on the beach. I'm finally on the island that I dreamed of. And these waves are like some of the best waves I've ever seen in my life. And I was just laughing. I was sitting on the beach laughing. I said, Krishna, you're about 10 years too late. Because I don't want to go out there anymore. You know, it's like I say, now you give it to me. You know? You know? So, but Krishna's like that. He tends to give you what you want at the point when you don't want it anymore, because then he knows you're okay. Right? So I never told anybody, but I was just laughing. I say, Krishna, this is a huge joke you're playing on me. It was like so funny. It was like, this is why, like, my dream, you know, on the dream island, the dream surf, and I'm watching, and I go, I have no desire anymore to do this. You know, why did you wait this long? So In the same way, when we come to this point where there's no desire to be honored, then Krishna says, okay, here, I'll make you an important person, you know. Maybe you can become an important figure in this country. Maybe you can become an important figure on television. People will know you. Or politically, or as a pandit, as a sadhu, or like Sanatan. What's his name? The cook? Sanatan Dharma. Become like Sanatan Dharma. You're going to become famous. So I have to tell you a story about Sanatan Dharma. When Sanatan Dharma, he joined what year? Like 1990 or something? Was that the time he came? Oh, he came to the White House. Oh. Okay. So he came to the White House. Oh, he left a long time, then he came back. Yeah. After a long time, then he showed up again. Very remorseful. Right? He came back. Yeah. I've been a bad boy, I've come back. Yeah. That was his mood. Right? But he was raised in a village. He wasn't well educated. He must have dropped out of school. He didn't speak English. So he wasn't so experienced in the world. I don't know what he was doing. Maybe he was farming or something. So, but he had this desire to serve. He always liked to serve. He always wanted to serve me. Prabhu, Prabhu, what should I do? So practically everything I asked him to do, he messed up. He didn't know how to do it. And so I'd ask him to do something. I'd say, why did you do it like that? You ruined everything. Oh, sorry, Prabhu, sorry, Prabhu. Right? So everything was like that. It was always... we had this rasa. Sorry, Prabhu, sorry, Prabhu. So I named him Hari Sorry. So I saw him for the first time 2 years ago in Mayapur. And I couldn't remember his name. I just said, oh, Hari Sorry. And he remembers Hari Sorry. Now, I don't know if all of you know, now that Mauritius has become a prosperous country, but I don't know if all of you know, or some of you remember, but I particularly remember when we were at the White House, one of the main preaching programs is we would go, you know, we'd go to different places, you know, do Namhattas, or, I don't know if they were Namhattas, but yeah, there were regular programs in different places, right? You know, Suriname, there's like a whole group of devotees. We'd go there once a week, we'd go here, go there. And we would go to the petrol station. And how much petrol would we put in the van? We put in exactly the amount of petrol we needed to get there and back, because that's all the money we have. We couldn't afford it. We never filled up the tank. We didn't have any money. It was just, or maybe we put in enough to get there and hope we'd get enough donations to put enough to get back. It was like that. There was no money. In 1981, I think Mauritius was in the top 10 of the poorest countries in the world. Very austere, wasn't it? Huh. And I had just come from South Africa, which at that point, South Africa was one of them, probably the top 10 wealthiest countries in the world. It was complete austerity from there to here. So things were difficult there. I don't know if everybody knows. We had no money. We had a lot of enthusiasm, but we didn't have any money. Anyway, so are there any questions or comments? Objections? Yes?
Just in a follow-up question. All the way from White House, right, you have to put my script in some manner or back to the next one. I think that's part of our application, and my friends here would share that.
For Bhagavatam, or why it's like that? Well,
have the same thing that it's really needed.
Yeah.
Any other tools that I know.
Oh, yeah.
So, now that's not so much
other things that can replace the Bhagavatam?
I've been a class in the format that we're doing now.
For educating and educating devotees. Devotees have pointed out that the five main practices of bhakti, which are hearing Bhagavatam is one of them, chanting, living in a holy place, worshipping the deity, and associating with devotees. These are the five, of the 64 items, these are the five most important. So many devotees have pointed out, in your morning program, you get all five. So Prabhupada incorporated the five most important items. You're in the holy dham, the temple. You're worshiping the deity. And worshiping the deity doesn't mean you're on the altar. It means you're participating in the temple. That's also deity worship, seeing the deity. Or the deity seeing you. Just being here doing kirtan. That's deity worship. And then you're chanting, of course, kirtan japa. You're getting sangha, because you're here with the devotees, and you're hearing Bhagavatam. So, Vasudev told me a story last night. He said he was in India a few years ago and he met Sindamini, and she was giving a class and she kept looking at him, and at the end of the class she said, "Do I know you?" And he said, "Yeah, from Mauritius." And he said she remembered his name. And he said that she said in the class, maybe Prabhupada told her in a letter or somewhere, I don't know, she said that Prabhupada said or told her, devotees who don't get up at 4 a.m. are not very serious. Interesting, huh? He said, the whole program, it's all in the morning. And what we're seeing in America and India now is that as these cultures become more materialistic, people are working longer. The companies are demanding it. Just the competition is so fierce. These companies have to. In most, where was I? In South Africa, not so much, but in America and India, people are working 12 hours a day. It's common, or at least between commuting and work, it's about 12 hours. When I grew up, it wasn't like that. When I grew up, my father worked, my mother didn't, and it was like 9 to 5, no problem. It's enough money. So things are changing. So what are devotees giving up when they're working harder, right? They're not giving up their sleep, they're giving up their morning program. So when you talk about sadhana, you also have to talk about what you do the rest of the day, because that's going to affect how much time you have for sadhana. So the whole discussion is, it's a holistic discussion. And it's interesting because as young devotees grow up, they choose occupations, but sometimes they don't realize that the occupation they're in is going to eat up all their time. And if they want to do sadhana in this particular occupation, they're not going to have time. In this occupation, they'll have time. And then you have this whole other phenomena, which is, it's like an undercurrent in ISKCON for varnashram and going back to the land, which is not very popular. And the devotees that are in that are very concerned that our devotees are becoming more and more absorbed or sucked into the culture and the materialistic way lifestyle. So it's a whole program. It's a whole discussion, because it's not isolated, because it's affected by choices you make about your life, how much time you're going to have. But if you wanted a purely philosophical answer, then it would be, I would say two things. The taste of the audience for hearing, and the ability of the speaker to create the taste. Because I've noticed in some temples, the reason Bhagavatam class isn't popular is because the speakers aren't that knowledgeable. They're not studying. They're not studying enough that you come to class and you're learning things. So it's like people think, why should I come to class? I don't learn anything. His classes are good for new devotees, but I've been around 30 years. I'm not learning anything. And then just the ruchi for hearing, which develops as part of our advancement. And sometimes the ruchi is not developing, so we don't want to hear. And I think also, like you said, just being in class with devotees, the importance of sangha. So, I had a really nice experience in a couple temples last year that I was doing workshops. And in one temple in America, I could see there was such a close connection between the leaders of the temple and how much they cared about the spiritual lives of the devotees, that they could get devotees in large numbers to participate in devotional programs because of that deep connection. They could just call them, like I did a workshop there. And we got about the same number of devotees that we're getting here, but there are only 300, maybe 200 in the community, 200-300, not thousands. And we got like 100, 150 devotees to come. And I was wondering, and I did a workshop before that, like a week before that, and we got 12 devotees to come. And I was wondering what the difference, why only 12 in this temple and 120 came in this temple, and the other congregation was actually bigger. Well, actually, there were other things going on that weekend, so maybe we would have got 40, but the congregation was twice the size, so then we should have got like 200. And I could see in that temple that got over 100, this very close connection between devotees and leadership, and the leadership was caring for the devotees. So they just said, you should come to the japa workshop, and everybody came. So I think that's also a part of it, you know, there's a connection. Then another nice thing that I learned from a devotee, he works at, he's in Bangalore, I think he works, I don't know if it's at Microsoft, but anyway, he works for a big company in Bangalore. And I was contemplating doing some workshops in corporations. So he manages like 80 people. So I was asking him, so how do you manage your people? And he said, I'm friends with everybody. I always ask them about their life. I counsel them. How's it going with your family, with your wife? Sometimes we take walks, we take breaks, and we just talk. And he said, in my department, no one leaves. But typically in India, I don't know about the rest of the world, but in these IT companies, there's always this huge turnover. You're always looking for a better job. And he said he has such a close relationship with them that he tells them, stay here, even if you can get a better job, make more money. Money's not that important. And they stay there, which is unusual for an Indian to not want to get a job that pays more money. He said, because the relationship. So I think that's part of it, relationships. And then they did another study, which is interesting, which may affect this. They did a study and they said that people, if they have an opinion and you present another opinion, which is actually better than their opinion or more correct, generally they won't listen to it and they become more convinced of their own opinion. Even if they hear facts to disprove what they believe, they cling to their own ideas more strongly. They said, except if the person who is speaking to convince them otherwise is someone they respect, then they'll listen to it. Then they change the way they think. So I think that also may be there. You know, when you respect the speaker, you're more open to hearing from them. When you don't respect them, it's like, well, kind of, you can turn them off. But I think also your point is that it's a principle. Prabhupada taught us. The whole morning program is a principle. And what I'm noticing now in our movement, it's kind of funny, because devotees, they're kind of like going full 360 degrees. We're like, you know, following Prabhupada very strictly as young devotees and then kind of neglecting a little bit as older devotees and then coming back to realize that the things they learned, to realize from a different perspective how important those things they learned are, the things they learned when they were young devotees are, you know, not taking it for granted as young devotee and then not doing it so well and then doing it again and realizing how important it is. Just like I teach japa workshops, and one of the common things that we experience in the japa workshops is very senior devotees testifying, say that I don't really think I ever chanted Hare Krishna properly before. I don't think I chanted like this. I never realized how powerful it is. I never realized how important it was to chant. But by going more deeply into the holy name, getting more realization, then they realize, this is really important. I didn't realize how important 16 rounds were. I mean, we knew it was important, we talked about it was important, but until you actually go very deeply into the holy name, you don't really realize how important it is, because you don't know what it can do, right? So then sometimes you see devotees, they get into Bhagavatam, they really get into it, and you can see it's like, wow, they're really getting into the Bhagavatam, they're relishing it, and they'll tell you, Bhagavatam is my life, I read it every day, you know? And so we read it every day as young devotees, but now there's a new perspective, so I think that's part of it, you know, you have to go more deeply into it. Satchinandan Swami said, he would always say in his workshop, he said, how long can you chant Hare Krishna without a taste? He said, you can't, you'll stop at some point. You have to go more deeply into it. So if you don't go more deeply into the practices and get more of a taste, then what will you do? You'll just work, you'll just go and do other things, right? And there's a funny story, because, you know, maybe around 1972, 73, you'll find that Prabhupada was really encouraging book distribution, because at that time, what was happening is the devotees were starting to distribute more and more books. So Prabhupada was now reciprocating by enthusing them, because they were becoming very enthused in book distribution, so Prabhupada wanted to enthuse them. So around that time, you'll start to see lots of letters where Prabhupada's encouraging the book distributors. And before that, you don't see so many. You might see, we should distribute books, let's do it. But 1973, 74, 75, 76, maximum number of books, of letters. This is pleasing me so much, I'm so happy, I'm so encouraged like that. So at that time, when all these letters were coming out, there was a group of householders under Prabhupada's direction who started a business called the Spiritual Sky Incense Business. And it was an amazing business, because all the householders in Los Angeles worked in that business, and the business was set up around the temple schedule. So the business started around 9, and temple schedule ended around 8:30. So everybody could, and everybody took breakfast together. They didn't eat at home. So it was like the grihastas lived across the street from the temple. They did the whole temple morning program. They ate breakfast together, and then they went to work together. And so work started at a time which was reasonable. And they all went to the evening program. And work ended, you know, like 5 o'clock, so everybody could come home. And this is a side point, but I'll get to my main point, but it's a nice point, because this never happened again. And they all had an apartment, so the business paid for the apartment. They got prasadam at the temple. And then they got a little salary, but the salary was half of what you would normally get, and so therefore it was considered that half their money was given in donation. So by working for the company, you were giving 50%. You had a place to live, you had food, and that business was supporting the school, and all their kids went to school there. So the business, nobody made money. It's not like one devotee was making money. It was a temple-run business. But everybody had a place to live. Everyone had prasadam. Everyone followed sadhana, and they were giving 50% of their money. They never got the 50%, so it was given. So anyway, and it was all the Vaishyas, you know, all the business people, you know. They were really good businessmen. The business was very successful. And Prabhupada encouraged them. So it was like perfect. So they're getting discouraged, because all these devotees are getting letters about book distribution or about college preaching and all these other things. So they write a letter to Prabhupada. They say, Srila Prabhupada, you're encouraging book distribution, you're encouraging college preaching. Right? At that time, they were developing diorama exhibits. You're encouraging the diorama exhibits. All the devotees are getting inspired, but you're not encouraging us in our business. And Prabhupada wrote them back. He said, you don't need encouragement in your business. By nature, you're already encouraged. You're already encouraged to do business. He said, you need encouragement in your sadhana. That was his letter. Isn't that funny? So, we all have a nature. Somebody has a nature to do business. Somebody has a nature to do art, music. Like if our sadhana isn't strong, then we just do whatever we do. And then it occupies all our time, right? And in some cases, you have to do things even if you don't want them. You have a family, you know? So it's a lot has to do with taste. And of course, a lot has to do with just understanding the principle and doing it. And then, as I said, the leadership, connecting with devotees, encouraging them, how are you doing? Is there anything I can do to help? We're having these nice classes. Or start some program, you know, Saturday morning, they have a special class. Devotees who are going to give the class, they prepare. So it's a really good class, something. But so that's what's so nice about being in Mayapur, because Bhagavatam classes are 200, 300, 400, 500 devotees. Two classes of 400 or 500 devotees each, because there, your life is simple. So having grown up in ISKCON, and when ISKCON was very simple, and seeing how complicated life has become, I hanker for that simple situation where, you know, there's a devotee business and, you know, it's geared around sadhana, and if you work in our company, you have to go to the morning program and the evening program. And you'll have a job and you'll work with devotees and you'll have insurance, health insurance, you won't have to worry. I mean, wow. You know. So I think that's also the idea of Varnashram, living off the land. That, you know, one time Prabhupada said, live in a city for preaching, but if you don't have to preach, live on the land, get away from it. Because you know the cities in the West, what they're like. It's horrible. It's very contaminated. You know, like here, funniest thing here, in America, we had gurukulas, right? And even in spite of our gurukulas, so many of our children didn't become good devotees. In Mauritius, you had no gurukulas, and all your kids became devotees. So what does that say? Look at the culture. And even in the West, we have a gurukula, it's hard for them to be devotees because of the culture. And even here, you don't need a gurukula, you don't have to have one, and your kids become good devotees because of the culture. So as society becomes more materialistic, you're dealing with more of that cultural influence. So, I mean, it's things that I dream about. I dream about these, you know. Ideally, I dream about these companies that are actually preaching Krishna consciousness. They're making money preaching, you know, some way, whether it is prasadam or through educational institution, or whatever it is, selling Prabhupada's books. We have a company that's actually spreading Krishna consciousness and making money and employing hundreds of devotees. You know, I say, wow, what could be better than that? And to work for the company, they have to go to the morning evening program. And they get home early enough to spend time with their family and still come to the evening arctic. Well, wouldn't that be nice? You had something like that, so many people would want to, you could engage so many people. Anyway, I like to dream. That's what I dream about. How do you want? Maybe you could, they do that in Israel. I was in Israel this year, and they have a law in Israel. I don't know what status these people are, but a certain status of Jewish people who are like the Brahmins, the government pays them, and their service is to study. And there's no monitoring. You know, I don't think it's like you have to teach so many classes. So they're Brahmins, they're just studying. Maybe you can get the government to support the Brahmins. So we have so many Brahmins they can teach. Give them a salary, give them a place. Why not? I'll tell you another story, really nice story. I was in New York last year, last summer I was in New York doing some business there, and I had some noise cancellation headphones and they broke, so I wanted to buy some new headphones. And there's a store there, it's called B&H Photo, and it's run by Hasidic Jews. Hasidic Jews are like ultra-conservative, like Orthodox Jewish people. And they established this business, and all the people working there are Hasidic Jews. That's, if you're not a Hasidic Jew, you can't work there. So it's for their own people. They established the business for their own people. And a very interesting thing happened. I was there, I got in the store about 5:45. The store closed at 6:30. At 6:30, there were probably 300 people shopping in that store. And they said, the store is closed, you have to leave. They could have, all the other stores stay open until 9. They could have easily done business to 9 o'clock. But it's their principle. They will close at 6:30. There's, you have Kentucky, you have the, no, there's a, what's it called? It's called Chick-fil-A. You have Chick-fil-A here? This is a, it's like a Colonel Sanders type thing. You have Colonel Sanders, Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's like a chicken place. And it's kind of cool because all their advertisements are don't eat cows, eat chicken. Just, if you're going to eat meat, better eat chicken. So they have all their ads are cows talking about how they're happy that you're eating chicken. But anyway, it's run by a Christian organization. And Chick-fil-A is a franchise. And they're in probably most malls in America because it's a franchise. And they're out and they're in other places aside from malls. But as you know, what's the big shopping day in the mall? It's Saturday and Sunday. But because it's a Christian organization, they don't believe in working on Sunday and they're closed. Like one of the biggest days for business, they're closed on Sunday. And they're usually a successful company, even they're closed on Sunday. And they maintain that principle. Interesting, isn't it? So, it's a couple of examples of religious organizations with businesses. Yeah, you can support Brahmins. If there are enough wealthy devotees that could support Brahmins, then fantastic. I'll sign up for the program. You can support me. We'll talk about the numbers later. But you have to buy me.
No.
Here's the stipulation. You have to buy me a house in Tamarind. You know. No, but you know, if I had a house in Tamarind, I'd be here all the time. You might never see me, but unless you come out there, but you know I'd be here, right? No, but we'll make it Brahminical. Yes. In what way, your nature means in what way to be active. So yeah, your nature, are you Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Sudra, and then subdivisions within that, you know. It's just so funny to see people's nature. Like some people, they love numbers. They just love numbers. Yeah. And other people, if you show them numbers, their eyes go blurry. And they just get sick and fall asleep and they run out of the office. It's a different nature. Right? Some people, you ask, give a lecture. And, I'd rather shoot me. I'd rather die than give a lecture. You know? Other people, I'll just give a lecture all day. You know, I could sit here, you know, 10 hours a day. We all have nature like that. Right? So. Use your nature in Krishna's service. And usually, because it's your nature, you'll do well. And one problem is, it's like, if you have a nature, let's say you have a brahminical nature, and then you're lamenting, I'm useless because I can't manage. That's wrong thinking. You know, because some devotees are like that. They lament or they feel guilty because they can't do something. No, but it's not your nature. Someone else can do it. Krishna didn't make you to do it. It's okay, you know. I can't make a lot of money. I was at Guru Gauranga's house. You remember Guru Gauranga, right? I'm at his house, right? So we're talking, you know. And Guru Gauranga's, you know, we're talking about business. He says, you know, well, you could do this. Comes up with an idea. I go, wow, amazing idea. He said, well, you could do this. Yeah. And I have another idea. You could do this, you know. He came up with like 20 ideas, right? Like each ingenious million-dollar business idea. He said, actually, I have to stop myself because if I don't stop myself, I'll just think about ways of making money, right? So that's his nature, right? So he told me last year or the year before, he had a business in America. Bhakti Charaswami started a business, but he ended up taking it over. It was a devotee-run business. somebody, he took it over, and then he built the business up, and then he decided to sell it. So he sold the business. You know. So I said, so what are you doing now? He said, well, I have enough money, I don't have to work, so I'm retired. And he was developing some programs for similar to what I was doing, for doing workshops in the corporate world, you know, helping people get more in the mode of goodness and then Krishna consciousness. And we were going to do something together. But in between, what happened is he went to South Africa and he has a cousin that has an idea for a project and he wants him to help. And Guru Gauranga doesn't have to do it because he's retired, but they're pushing him to do it. I said, well, are you going to do it or are you going to do this other program, you know, workshops in the corporation? So he said, well, you're pushing me and there's this other person who likes me a lot because I saved him like $20 million he was going to invest and I told him not to. So now he's willing to invest $20 million in the business and I've got Infosys in India, they're interested, you know. And this is all, he doesn't have to work, it all comes to him. And he says, well, I go, you're going to do it? And he says, well, you know, if I just put these people together, I could probably make a few million dollars. Yeah. So it's like, it's just, you know, it's just who he is, you know, it's just, you know. And then, you know, take someone like, who's very brahminical, right? Extremely intelligent, extremely whatever, but money is not, you know, it's not part of their, you know, it's just, you know. And if they try to make money in any other way than brahminical way, it's hard for them. They could make money as a Brahmin, but they may or may not, but that's how they could best do it. So once you recognize that, then it's not like, oh, I'm useless, I can't make money. And then, you know, what should I do? Okay, I don't read books anymore, I just go out, you know, start, you know, I'll work 25 jobs, and, you know, what's the point? You understand what you're good at and you're happy with, be happy with them. As long as your wife's happy with it, that's another thing. Because she may want you to make more money. So what happens is a lot of us, we feel guilty or we're upset with ourselves because we're not good in an area, in some area, and we feel guilty. Well, I should be good in that area. No, you're just not. It's okay if you're not good in that area. Just someone else is good in that area. So work with someone who's good. Like right now, I'm working on this project to develop these workshops in India, in the corporate world. So I sought out a business person because I want him to partner with me because I know if I work with him, he'll make it successful financially. I know I can make it successful, but he'll make it more successful financially because he thinks in terms of, okay, don't do this because you won't make money. I would just do it because it'll help people. But he'll say, no, well, if you help people, make sure it makes money also. You know, so he'll think that way. And I naturally won't think that way. He'll think more about what makes money, I'll think more about what helps people. So I team up with him and then it works. So I don't have to sit there and lament, oh, I'm not good at making money. Just find someone who's good, work with them. I don't know if that answered your question, but yeah. Okay. Anything else? What do you do on Ekadasi? You fast in the morning or you have breakfast? Time for breakfast? Okay. Srila Prabhupada ki jai. Go Premanandi. Hari Hari Bol.